And so as we discussed last time, already kind of at the level of mean field theory, we can see an important difference from the case of the Ising model, right? So for the Ising model, so if you plot the free energy versus phi, right, then so below the critical temperature, it has this form, right? So there are two minima at some, you know, plus let's say m and minus m. Okay, and so even though the two minima correspond to the same value of the free energy, right? Once the system chooses a particular minimum, to get to another one, it has to overcome this energy barrier, and the size of this energy barrier is infinite in an infinite system, right? It's proportional to the volume of the system. And so therefore, once the system chooses one particular minimum, it's gonna stay there. Okay. However, in this case, right, this figure becomes actually a figure of rotation, right? And so then, actually going between different minima corresponding to different directions of n costs absolutely no energy. Okay? And so we can expect that this difference is going to play a role, and indeed it does. Okay. Okay. So let's now see explicitly how this continuous symmetry makes a difference for the physics. So let me start with a mean field solution and consider small fluctuations about it. Okay? So let me start from a mean field theory solution where, so I will assume that the expectation value of my field phi is equal to rho times n, where, so I obtain rho by minimizing this uniform mean field free energy. So rho is equal to square root of minus r divided by u, right? And so let me take n. N is arbitrary, right? Any direction is good. So let me just take n to be 1, 0, 0, 0. So unit vector in the one, in the direction 1, 1, 0, 0. So there are n components, since we are talking about n component spins. Okay. And now, so let me consider small fluctuations of phi about this, its mean field value. So I'll write phi in the following way as rho times n, so that's its mean field value, plus a small fluctuation. I'll just parameterize it in the following way. I'll write it as rho times delta phi, where delta phi is small. And I've multiplied this by rho just for convenience, okay? So this fluctuation delta phi, I will further decompose into a fluctuation along this ordering direction and the rest of them, okay? So I'll write it as delta phi 1 times the vector n. So this will be fluctuation of phi along the ordering direction. And then plus, so I'll call it delta phi perp. So perp stands for perpendicular to the ordering direction. So these are fluctuations in all the n minus 1 transverse directions. Okay, so delta phi perp is equal to, by definition, 0, delta phi 2, and so on, delta phi sub n, right? (Clears throat) Okay, and so now let me take this and plug this into this Landau-Ginzburg functional, leaving only terms of up to second order in fluctuations. Okay. So let's do just all the terms separately. Let me go back to my expression for Landau functional in terms of phi, the phi field itself. So I have integral d dx, 1/2 grad phi a dot grad phi a plus r over 2 phi dot phi plus u over 4 phi dot phi squared, okay? So let's first look at this term, phi dot phi. It's the simplest, so phi dot phi. And so this is going to be rho squared, right? N plus delta phi dot n plus delta phi. So this is equal to rho squared. Okay, so n dot n is 1, right, plus 2 n dot delta phi, sorry, and then plus delta phi dot delta phi, right? Now, okay, so this is the projection of my delta phi on the direction of n. So this is delta phi 1, right? So this is equal to rho squared 1 plus 2 delta phi 1, right? And so this contains both delta phi 1 squared and then plus delta phi perp dot delta phi perp, right? Okay, now let's calculate this term. So phi dot phi squared. And so I want to square this, but expand this to only quadratic order in the fluctuations. So I'll get rho to the fourth 1 plus 2 delta phi 1 plus delta phi 1 squared plus delta phi perp dot delta phi perp squared. And so this is approximately equal to rho to the fourth. So 1 plus 4 delta phi 1 plus 2 delta phi 1 squared plus 2 delta phi perp dot delta phi perp, and then plus 4 delta phi 1 squared, right? Coming from squaring this, so let me just write this as 6 delta phi 1 squared. And that's it at up to second order in the fluctuations, right? Okay, now finally let's look at this term. So we have grad phi a dot grad phi a. Okay. So this will be rho squared grad delta phi 1 squared, right? And then plus rho squared grad delta phi perp eighth component dot grad delta phi perp eighth component, right? And that's it. Okay, so now let's just collect all of the terms here and put them back into the Landau functional. Okay, so I have S of phi is equal to integral d dx, so 1/2 rho squared grad delta phi 1 squared plus 1/2 rho squared grad delta phi perp eighth component dot grad delta phi perp eighth component, right? So then I have r over 2 times this thing plus so r rho squared over 2 so 1 plus 2 delta phi 1 plus delta phi 1 squared, 1 squared plus delta phi perp dot delta phi perp, and then finally plus u over 4. Sorry? Yeah, thank you. This is delta phi 1. Okay, and then plus, so u rho to the fourth over 4. So 1 plus 4 delta phi 1 plus 4 delta phi 1. Plus delta phi 6 delta phi 1 squared. 6 delta phi 1 squared and plus 2 delta phi perp squared. Okay. Plus 2 delta phi perp dot delta phi perp. Okay. Okay, so let's first look at the terms which are linear in the fluctuations, right? So, okay, so the coefficient of delta phi 1 here is going to be r rho squared, right, plus u rho to the fourth, plus u rho to the fourth. But rho itself is a solution of the mean field equation, right? So rho squared is equal to minus r divided by u, right? R is negative since t is less than tc. So then this thing vanishes identically, right? As it should, again, because we are expanding about the minimum of the Ginzburg-Landau functional, and therefore terms which are linear in fluctuations have to vanish, okay? So this goes away. Okay, so now let's calculate, let's just simplify the coefficients of delta phi 1 squared and delta phi perp squared. So let me first look at the coefficient of delta phi perp squared, actually. So it's gonna be so the coefficient of delta phi perp dot delta phi perp. So it's equal to 1/2 r rho squared plus 1/2 u rho to the fourth. And so you see that this also vanishes for exactly the same reason. Okay, so this is already something new. So the coefficient of delta phi perp squared actually goes away as well. Okay, so this is zero. Okay, now finally let's calculate the coefficient of delta phi 1 squared. So I get, again, 1/2 r rho squared plus 3/2, right? Plus 3/2 u rho to the fourth. Okay, so this is not going to vanish. Okay. And so using this equation, I'm going to get, so this is 1/2 r rho squared minus 3/2 r rho squared. So the coefficient is just equal to minus r times rho squared. So this is going to be, this is the same as r squared divided by u, or minus r squared divided by u, right? Plus. Right? Or I will actually leave it in the following form as rho squared times absolute value of r. Okay, so then finally we get the following result for the Landau functional expanded to quadratic order in fluctuations. So I get s of phi is equal to, and of course, yeah, so here I've only included already the contribution of fluctuations. I've neglected the Landau functional, the value of Landau functional exactly at the value of Landau functional at the mean field point, right? So this is s of delta phi, right? So my s of delta phi is equal to integral d dx, so 1/2 rho squared grad delta phi 1 squared plus 1/2 rho squared grad delta phi perp a dot grad delta phi perp a, right? And plus rho squared times absolute value of r times delta phi 1 squared, okay? So very simple result, and so this what is the physical meaning of this? So the physical meaning of this is the following. So you see that so if you look at fluctuations of phi along the ordering direction, right? These costs energy even when delta phi 1 is spatially uniform, right? So there is an energy cost that's proportional to just delta phi 1 squared. And even if delta phi 1 squared is constant, this is still non-zero. Okay? And then there is an additional energy cost for making delta phi 1 non-constant. However, so if you look at the fluctuations in all the transverse directions, right, and those can be precisely be thought of as fluctuations of the direction of phi, right, those actually do not cost any energy if they are spatially uniform. Okay? There is no delta phi perp squared term. Its coefficient is zero. So these fluctuations in the transverse directions only cost energy if they are spatially non-uniform. Okay? So this is precisely kind of a mathematical expression of that statement that I made before, that fluctuations of the direction of phi cost no energy because they are all equivalent. Okay? So the lack of delta phi perp squared term in here is the expression of the O of n symmetry. Lack of delta phi perp squared term in S of delta phi is a consequence of the O of n symmetry. Okay. Okay. So now let's see in more detail what are the consequences of this. So what are the physical consequences of the fact that these transverse fluctuations only cost energy if they are spatially non-uniform? Okay. So let me raise this thing. Okay, so let's, as we usually do, rewrite this Landau-Ginzburg functional in Fourier space. So Fourier transform. So I can say that delta phi 1 of x is going to be 1 over v sum over k delta phi 1 of k e to I k dot x, right? And I can transform this to an integral over k if I want to, right? This is our usual prescription that 1 over v sum over k is integral d dk to pi to the d. And same for delta phi perp of x. So this is 1 over v sum over k delta phi perp of k e to I k dot x, right? So if I plug these in the Landau functional, so I guess I will skip the actual substitution of this. We have done this already a number of times. So what we get is the following result, that S of delta phi is equal to, so rho squared divided by 2v, sum over k, okay? So when I Fourier transform the gradients, each gradient gives me a power of k, right? So grad squared gives me k squared. So I get k squared modulus of delta phi 1 of k squared, right, plus k squared delta phi perp a of k dot delta phi perp a of minus k. You remember that phi of minus k is always equal to phi complex conjugate of k because of the reality of phi in real space. And then plus, so what remains here is 2 modulus of absolute value of r, and then delta phi 1 of k squared, right? Okay, and so again, the expression of the symmetry in Fourier space is that the energy cost of transverse modes, of transverse fluctuations, goes to zero as k goes to zero, right? So the energy cost of delta phi perp a of k fluctuations vanishes in the limit k going to zero. So such modes are called Goldstone modes. So these are Goldstone modes, so the modes whose energy cost, whose energy vanishes in the limit of zero wave vector. Okay. And so Goldstone modes always appear whenever a continuous symmetry is spontaneously broken, like in our case, right? So in our in our mean field solution, right, we've chosen a particular direction for the expectation value of phi. In doing that, we've broken spontaneously this O(f)n symmetry, right? Since S of phi by itself is completely symmetric with respect to all rotations, right? However, the solution, the mean field solution, breaks that symmetry, right? And so a consequence of that spontaneously broken continuous symmetry is the appearance of these Goldstone modes, okay? So Goldstone modes always accompany spontaneously broken continuous symmetry. And so these Goldstone modes really appear in many different contexts in physics. So, you know, in condensed matter, probably the simplest context in which they appear is in the formation of crystals, right? So a crystal, when it forms, breaks symmetry of continuous symmetry of translations in space, right? So space is uniform. So every position in space is as good as any other one. But when the crystal forms, atoms choose a particular average positions in which they reside, right? So that choice spontaneously breaks the symmetry of translations in space, okay? However, so the remnant of that symmetry is the appearance of soft phonon modes. Okay, so the Goldstone modes in this case, so I'm sure you will see this in your condensed matter class. So Goldstone modes are acoustic phonons, which are just basically quantized fluctuations of the atom density in the crystal. Okay. And so as a consequence of the spontaneously broken symmetry of translations in space, their energy vanishes linearly with the wave vector, okay? So the energy of phonons is equal to h bar times the speed of sound in the crystal times k, okay? So it vanishes when k is going to zero, and so what this means basically is that a phonon in the limit of zero wave vector, which means infinite wavelength, simply corresponds to the displacement of the whole crystal in space, right? And that costs no energy because all positions in space are equivalent. So these Goldstone modes also appear, of course, in particle physics, where this name originated. So this is basically a mechanism for the appearance of massless particles in particle physics. Okay, so like photons, for example, right, arise due to the spontaneous breaking of electroweak symmetry. Okay, so photon, which, you know, the energy of the photon has exactly the same form, except is the speed of sound replaced by the speed of light. So photon is also a Goldstone mode. Okay. Okay, but so for us, so let's see what the consequences of the appearance of Goldstone modes are in our case. So let me erase this here. So let me do the following one now. Let me calculate the correlation functions corresponding to these different modes. To the modes delta phi 1 and the Goldstone modes, delta phi perf. Yeah.
So I need to ask, when we were in position space, then you said that there is no energy needed if we go basically around the minimum of the potential.
Right.
And here, there's no, the phi transverse terms disappear for k going to 0.
Right.
So how can I connect those two?
Well, so it just means that, the energy going to 0 when k is going to 0, right? So when k is going to 0, delta phi perp simply corresponds to uniform rotation of the field phi, right? Mm-hmm. While delta phi 1, the reason it does cost energy is because this corresponds to actually changing the magnitude of delta phi 1, of phi, mm-hmm. right? And that does cost energy. Okay, so let's calculate correlation functions of delta phi 1 of x and delta phi perp of x. Okay. So let's start with delta phi 1. Let me call this g1 of x minus x prime, right? And so this will be an expectation value of the of delta phi 1 of x delta phi 1 of x prime, right? I don't have to subtract, average of delta phi 1 times average of delta phi 1, because that's 0 by definition. Delta phi are fluctuations. Okay? So if I write this in Fourier space, I'm going to get 1 over v squared sum over k, right? Delta phi 1 of k, delta phi 1 of minus k times e to I k dot x minus x prime, right? And so this, if you remember from when we calculated the correlation function in mean-tilt theory for the Ising model, this average is just given by inverse of the coefficient of delta phi 1 of delta phi 1 squared in this Fourier transformed Landau functional, right? So I can immediately write down the answer for this correlation function. So delta phi 1 of k, delta phi 1 of minus k is just equal to v divided by rho squared. So 1 divided by k squared plus 2 absolute values of r, right? Right? Okay, so in the same way, I can define a correlation function g perp for the Goldstone modes. Okay. So this is going to be an expectation value of delta phi perp A of x, delta phi perp A of x prime. Right, and this is summation, I'm going to sum over all the components here, right? Summation over A is implicit. So this is equal to, again, 1 over V squared, sum over K, delta phi perp A of K, delta phi perp A of minus K, and e to I k dot x minus x prime. And then this expectation value is, again, the coefficient, the inverse of the coefficient of the corresponding term in the Landau functional. So I get delta phi perp a of minus k is v divided by rho squared, and then 1 over k squared, okay? And so you remember that, so what this form of the correlation between the Fourier components imply, right, is that, okay, so here I have k squared, therefore this thing here must have dimensions of inverse length squared, right? And this length is nothing but the correlation length. So the fact that there is a finite 1 over xi squared in here means that the correlation length is finite. So the correlation length for delta phi 1 is finite. Okay. While here, this term is absent. Right. And so the correlation function of the Goldstone modes looks like the correlation function of fluctuations in the Ising model right at the critical point where the correlation length has diverged, okay? So what this means is the correlation length of the Goldstone modes is always infinite, not just at the critical point, but always, right? For all t less than tc. Okay, so it follows from here that g1 of x minus x prime is going to be proportional to 1 over x minus x prime to the power d minus 2, right, as follows from the just counting dimensions, and I'm ignoring the possibility of anomalous dimension here. So we are just doing expansion around mean field theory, and then e to minus x minus x prime divided by xi, where xi is equal to 1 over square root of 2 mod r, right? While for the Goldstone modes, g perp of x minus x prime does not have the exponential, so it's just 1 over x minus x prime to d minus 2. So this means that correlation length for Goldstone modes is always infinite, okay? Okay, so finally, now let me use this result here to calculate the a mean square fluctuation of phi at some point x due to Gauss tone modes. Okay. So let's erase this. So just one more remark, I guess. So if you want to kind of translate all of this into the language of particle physics, then so this would become propagator, right, of the corresponding particles. And so you see that so these particles corresponding to the fluctuations of phi along the ordering directions. So these particles are massive. So you can think of this as kind of relativistic dispersion, k squared plus m squared. There is a finite mass, while Goldstone particles are massless. Okay? Their energy just again vanishes as the momentum goes to zero. Okay, so now let's just evaluate the mean square fluctuation of phi of x due to Gauss tone modes. So what I want to evaluate is something like this. So delta phi perp A of x, delta phi perp A of x, right, which is just the same as the correlation function take evaluated when at the point when x is equal to x prime, right? So this is equal to just g perp of 0, right? And so this is going to be, so here I forgot one thing, that since I've summed over all the components of the Goldstone modes, right? There has to be a prefactor here that just counts their number. So it's a prefactor of n minus 1 here, right? Okay, so then I get n minus 1 divided by rho squared, right? And then so v divided by 1 over v squared, that's 1 over v, sum over k of 1 over k squared, right? And so let's now convert this to an integral over k. So I get n minus 1 divided by rho squared, and then integral dtk 2 pi to the d 1 over k squared, right? So this I can rewrite in spherical coordinates in the following way as d, the surface area of unit sphere in d dimensions, divided by 2 pi to the d, right? And then integral from 0 to lambda dk, so I get k to d minus 1 minus 2, so this will be k to d minus 3, okay? And so now the question is whether this integral converges or not, right? So if the integral converges, that means that Goldstone modes give a finite contribution to the fluctuation of phi, right? Which means that the mean field theory, at least as far as the description of the phase, of the ordered phase is concerned, is fine, okay? However, if this integral diverges, so that means that our assumption that we started from, that there is a mean field solution, is incorrect, okay? So what this means is that if this integral diverges, there is no ordered phase, okay? At any temperature, the expectation value of phi would always be zero, okay? And so it's clear here that if d is greater than 2, then this integral is going to converge, right? So strictly greater than 2, the integral converges, which means that there is an ordered phase characterized by some finite TC, right? With a finite TC, which is greater than zero, right? Such that for T less than TC, I have a non-zero average of the of phi. Okay. However, if d is less or equal to 2, then this integral diverges at the lower limit, which implies that there is no ordered phase. Okay. So if d is less or equal to 2, okay, the integral diverges, and so this implies that TC, and I can say that this is TC as a function of D. So for D less or equal to 2, TC of D is 0. So we only have a paramagnetic phase, right, where the average of phi is always 0. Okay, so this dimensionality, so d is equal to 2, this is called lower critical dimension, right? So remember that we had upper critical dimension, d equals 4, right? So this is lower critical dimension. So d equals 2 is called lower critical dimension, right? So so when d is greater than 4, mean field theory is exact, okay? As I start decreasing dimensionality below 4, mean field theory becomes non-exact, right? But there is still an ordered phase, right? Although the critical temperature starts decreasing away from the mean field critical temperature, from the mean field critical temperature as a function of dimensionality. And eventually, so if I have a system with continuous symmetry, eventually when d is equal to 2, the critical temperature goes to 0, okay? And there is no longer an ordered phase.
I thought it was one dimension.
It's one dimension for the Ising model, right? So Ising model has a discrete symmetry. So this is all of this is it applies to systems with continuous symmetry. Okay. So this statement is called a Merman-Wagner theorem. And I think so. These are two condensed matter physicists. I guess particle physicists. Also at Coleman here, usually. So it's Merman-Wagner theorem, which states that so there is no long range order below below d equals 2, at and below d equals 2 in systems with continuous symmetry. Okay. So in low dimensions, fluctuations are whenever you have continuous symmetry, fluctuations are always so strong that they destroy long range order at any finite temperature. Okay. Okay, and so this, the appearance of this lower critical dimension, so the fact that in systems with continuous symmetry, lower critical dimension is not 1, but 2, right? So that's the main effect of the Goldstone modes, right? Because this divergence is precisely a consequence of the Goldstone modes, right? It's a consequence of the fact that this propagator of the Goldstone modes diverges when k goes to 0. Okay, there is no correlation length to cut off that divergence. Okay. Okay. So so what I want to spend maybe one lecture talking about is the physics that occurs in systems with continuous symmetry. Near and at this lower critical dimension. Okay, so it turns out that it's not just that you know in d equals 2 there is no long range order at all. It's the things are actually more subtle than this, or there is no order at all. There is no long range order. That's true, but there can be more subtle order that exists in such systems in two dimensions. Okay. So okay. So what can we do here? So it turns out that we can use this fact that the critical temperature vanishes as dimensionality approaches 2. We can use this fact to set up a different epsilon expansion to figure out the critical properties. So this is called 2 plus epsilon expansion. So expansion in the deviation of dimensionality from the lower critical dimension. I will not go through any of the technical details. They're a little less pretty than in the 4 minus epsilon expansion. So I'll mostly just talk about the results. Okay, so let's assume that dimensionality is close to 2, okay? And so let me introduce again epsilon, which is going to be equal to d minus 2. And let's assume that epsilon is small, right? And so physically, what is small when epsilon is small is the critical temperature, right? So I can say that Tc of d when d is approaching 2 is going to 0, right? So Tc of d as d approaches 2 from above goes to 0, right? So can set up a 2 plus epsilon expansion. Okay, but before we go there, let me simplify my Landau-Ginzburg Ginzburg functional a little bit. So let me write again my Landau-Ginzburg functional in terms of rho and n, right? In terms of the magnitude of the field phi and its direction. going to be 1/2 integral ddx, integral ddx, 1/2 rho squared grad n a dot grad n a, right, plus 1/2 grad rho squared, right, plus r over 2 rho squared plus u over 4 rho to the fourth. And so what I can expect if my dimensionality is close to 2, right, is that actually only the fluctuations of the direction of phi are going to be important, right? The magnitude of phi, rho, is going to be fluctuating only very weakly because it costs finite energy, even when rho is uniform, right? So near d equals 2, we can assume that rho is just fixed, right? And its magnitude is going to be roughly its magnitude that we obtain from the solution of the mean field theory, right? So it's going to be roughly fixed to rho equals minus square root of r divided by u, right? While n can fluctuate, okay? So then what I can do is just throw out this part, right? Because rho is just constant, and write my Landau-Ginzburg functional as a functional of the direction of phi only, okay? So s of n then is going to be rho squared over 2 integral d dx grad n a dot grad n a, okay? So basically this functional that's going to describe the physics near the lower critical dimension. So this is called a nonlinear sigma model. Sigma model or NLSM. Why it's called sigma doesn't matter. The name comes again from particle physics. Why is it nonlinear? Okay. So if you just look at this, right, naively, it seems like this model can actually be exactly solved, right? Because this is a quadratic functional of n, right? And quadratic functional implies that you know, the integral for the partition function is a Gaussian integral.
It's normalized.
Right? Right. But the point is that you know, this is too naive, right? The point is that this n here is actually a unit vector, right? So the integral over n is not actually a Gaussian integral, because we have to remember that n is a unit vector, okay? And so that's what nonlinear refers to, okay? Yeah?
Can you explain again how we know that rho is constant?
Well, it's just that, so, you know, all of this physics near d equals 2, right, is a consequence of Goldstone modes. And the Goldstone modes are fluctuations of n. Right? So the reason that they have such a significant effect, you know, killing long-range order near d equals 2, is precisely because of this property that so the fluctuations in n only cost energy when n is non-uniform. So there is no term proportional to you know, n squared, right? While for rho, there is such a term. There is a term in the lambda. So the fluctuations in rho cost energy even when rho is uniform. So So therefore, you know, roughly we can just ignore the fluctuations in rho completely. They are not zero, but they are small, so unimportant, and focus only on the fluctuations of n. And so usually this Landau functional for the nonlinear sigma model is written in a slightly different form. So let me just rename this rho squared. Let me call this 1 over t, where t is the temperature, right? It has to be something that's proportional to 1 over t, right? Because you know the partition function of this nonlinear sigma model. So integral dm e to minus s of n, right? So what controls the magnitude of this Boltzmann weight is the temperature, right? So therefore, there has to be a temperature in the denominator here, right? So rho squared has to be proportional to 1 over t, right? But let's just call it 1 over t then. Let's ignore the differences. I have s of n is 1 over 2t, okay, d dx, grad na dot grad na, right? And so now I can set up, again, to 2 plus epsilon expansion and derive Rg flow equations for t using the fact that we expect that this t at the fixed point is going to be small, is going to be proportional to epsilon. Okay, so we can derive, let me go here, and again, I will skip the details of the derivation. It's in principle follows exactly the same lines as what we have done explicitly for the Ising model, but it's less pretty and more technical. Okay. So Rg flow equation for nonlinear sigma model, again, to order epsilon, has the following form. So dt tilde, I will explain what t tilde is in a second, dl. So the first term is just going to be the dimension. So minus epsilon t tilde plus n minus 2, n is the number of components of n, of the vector n, times kd times t tilde squared, right? So t tilde is just t times lambda to the epsilon. So it's basically dimensionless temperature, right? And kd is s sub d 2 pi to the d, okay? Okay, so let's analyze this equation now. Okay, so let's find the fixed points first. So clearly there are two fixed points. So t tilde star equals 0, right? And then the second one, t tilde star proportional to epsilon, as we expect. So equals epsilon divided by kd times n minus 2. Okay. So if I analyze the stability of those fixed points, again, let me just skip the details. It goes exactly along the same lines as before. What we'll find is that this fixed point is always stable. Okay, so the flow goes always into this fixed point, while this fixed point is always unstable. And so this corresponds precisely to the critical temperature. Okay, so the RG flow in this case, which is very simple, it's just one dimensional, because there's just one coupling constant here, just the temperature. So the RG flow has a following form. So here is a fixed point corresponding to zero temperature, right? Here is this other fixed point, so epsilon divided by kd n minus 2, okay? So this fixed point is always unstable, so flows go out of it in both directions, while this fixed point is stable, okay? And so this fixed point corresponds to critical point, right? If I deviate from the critical point towards lower temperatures, I flow to the ordered phase. And so this fixed point at t equals 0 corresponds to the ordered phase, okay? While the fixed point at infinite temperature corresponds to a disordered phase, right? So I expect, just by looking at the, again, at the nonlinear sigma model, that when t equals 0, right, I want n to just be uniform, right? While t is infinite, I want n to fluctuate wildly, because there is no cost in that case for fluctuations. Okay, so this flow then has, you know, very simple interpretation, but it's actually the same as the interpretation for the Ising model, for the phi to the fourth theory, right? So again, there are only two types of fixed points corresponding to phases where correlation length is zero and a critical point where correlation length diverges. Okay? And so again, the critical temperature, so the fixed point corresponding to the critical point is proportional to epsilon in accordance with the Merman-Wagner theorem, right? So as I take epsilon to 0, as I take the dimensionality to 2, this fixed point disappears. So which means that when d approaches 2, phase transition disappears, right? So if I take now d exactly equal to 2, right, epsilon is 0, which means that this term is absent now, okay? So I have dt tilde dl equals just n minus 2 kd t tilde squared, right? And so that means that so any deviation of t tilde from 0 results in flow to infinite temperature, right? Okay. So this property is called asymptotic freedom. And so it's in fact exactly the same as the place where you may have heard the name, the context in which you may have heard this name, asymptotic freedom, is the context of the theory of strong interactions, right? The theory of strong interactions between quarks. So in that case, this is a four-dimensional, right? Three space plus one time, four-dimensional Young-Mills theory, okay? And so it turns out that that four-dimensional Young-Mills theory has some deep connections to two-dimensional nonlinear sigma model. So in particular, the RG flow equation for the four-dimensional Young-Mills theory, you know, for the derivation of which, I guess, Gross, Vilcek, and somebody else got Nobel Prize. I forget the name. So this RG flow equation is exactly the same as the RG flow equation for the nonlinear sigma model, right? So in the context of the quarks, that the interpretation of this RG flow equation is that quarks interact weakly at short length scales, okay? But as you coarse grain, as I increase my length scale, the interaction grows without bound, okay? So the quarks are always confined. So here is the same thing. So basically, the what this flow means, right, is that the correlation length here may be finite in my kind of starting nonlinear sigma model. But once I do coarse graining, once I start doing RG, that correlation length just goes to zero, right? So if you equate the correlation length here with the kind of the distance between the quarks, so that's the same similar idea, okay? Okay. Okay, so now another interesting thing that we can see from this equation is that the case when the vector n has two components seems to be special, right? So in this case, the right-hand side just vanishes. And it actually can be shown that this doesn't happen only to order t squared. It actually happens to all orders in t, okay? So so the case n equals 2 and d equals 2 is special. And so you can see it from here by the fact that the beta function, right? You remember that the right-hand side of the RG flow equation is by definition the beta function. So the beta function in this case vanishes identically. And so this is a kind of sign that something special happens in this case, okay? And so I want to spend the remaining time and probably plus the next lecture talking about this special case, okay? Okay, so let me again look at the nonlinear sigma model Landau functional. Okay, so I have 1 over 2t integral d dx grad na dot grad na, right? And so explicitly, in the case of n equals 2, so n is just a two-component vector. Okay? So let me take n to be, let's say, nx times x hat plus ny times y hat. Right, and since n is a unit vector, I must have that an x squared plus an y squared is equal to 1, right? So it's clear that I can solve this very nicely if I just say that an x is equal to cosine of some theta and an y is equal to sine of theta, right? Then this condition here is solved automatically. So I choose an x equals cosine theta and y equals sine of theta, so where theta is an angular variable, so it can be anywhere between 0 and 2 pi, right? So theta is defined in the interval from 0 to 2 pi, right? Okay, so let me rewrite then this functional in terms of theta. So I get grad NA dot grad NA. So this is going to be so the derivative of cosine is sine. So I get sine squared theta times grad theta squared plus cosine squared theta times grad theta squared. And so very nicely, this sums up to 1, right? So then I get just grad theta squared, okay? Looks very deceptively simple, okay? And so then I have my nonlinear sigma modal Landau functional. It just depends on this angular variable theta then. 1 over 2t integral d dx grad theta squared, okay? And so here, again, this is just kind of common notation. So usually this variable rho is actually reinstated in here. But not completely. So I will write this 1 over 2t now as rho s divided by 2t. Okay, again, this is just notation. So I will change this to some parameter rho s, which is positive, divided by 2t integral d dx grad theta squared, okay? And so this, again, so this just looks very simple, right? It looks, again, like just a Gaussian theory, which is exactly solvable, okay? Of course, this is, again, deceptive because it's not a Gaussian theory, and the reason here is that this theta is not just an unbounded real variable that can vary between minus infinity and infinity. That would be a Gaussian theory then, and it would be exactly solvable. But theta here is compact, okay? And so this, again, makes this problem non-trivial. But let's, for a start, let's just pretend that we don't know this. So let's just treat this variable theta as simply a real variable and see what we get, okay? Thank you. Okay, so let's pretend. We don't know theta is compact. It's defined in a finite interval. And treat it as a real field. Then this model is actually exactly solved. So I can take, for example, exactly evaluate the correlation function of theta. Okay, so let's do that. Let me define this correlation function in the following way, just for convenience. So I will define g of x not as a correlation function of thetas, right? Because what I really want is correlation function of n's, right? And so let me write this in the following way as a correlation of the exponential e to I theta of x, right? And then e to minus I theta of 0, okay? So, you know, so then the real part of this exponential is going to be the x component of n, and the imaginary part of the exponential is going to be the y component of n. Okay, so let's calculate this correlation function. So my definition is going to be 1 over z. So functional integral over all configurations of theta, then e to I theta of x minus theta of 0, right? And then e to minus s of theta, okay? Now, so a result, the kind of mathematical result that I will not prove here, but which you probably could prove in your tutorial, is that when s of theta is Gaussian, meaning when s of theta is a quadratic functional of theta, so it follows from the applying the cumulant expansion and Wieck's theorem that this is just equal to e to minus 1/2 average of the square of the theta of x minus theta of 0 squared. Okay. So theta of x minus theta of 0 squared average. Okay. So this is true for quadratic s of theta. Okay. Okay. So let's evaluate then this this average here. So I have average of theta of x minus theta of 0 squared, right? So this is equal to average of theta squared of x plus theta squared of 0 minus 2 theta of x times theta of 0, right? So now by translational symmetry of the system, the average of theta squared of x is going to be the same as average of theta squared of 0, right? Because all points are equivalent. So then I can write this as twice average of theta squared of 0 minus theta of x times theta of 0, right? And now let me just, so let me evaluate this again by going to Fourier space, right? So this is going to be equal to, so twice integral from 0 to lambda d2k1 to pi squared, so we are in two dimensions, right? d2k2 to pi squared, average. So I get theta of k1 from here, let's say theta of k2, and then minus theta of k1 times theta of k2 e2, so I k1 dot x, right? And now, so the expectation value of theta in Fourier space, we can again just read off from our Ginzburg-Landau functional, right? It's going to be again the inverse of the coefficient of theta squared of k in here when I Fourier transform this. So theta of k1, theta of k2 average is going to be, so t divided by rho s k1 squared, and then 2 pi squared delta of k1 plus k2, right? So then I get the following result. That so the average of theta squared theta of x minus theta of zero squared is equal to so I get 2t divided by rho s, right? Only one integral over k remains due to the delta function. So integral from zero to lambda d2k 2 pi squared, right? 1 over k squared, and then 1 minus e to I k dot x, okay? Okay, so tomorrow we will evaluate this integral and find the correlation function.